The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Welcome, everybody. You hear me? Doobie 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 doobie. Yes. There we are. Okay. Too loud now, or is it okay? Maybe a little loud? Victor? Yeah? Yeah? Better like this? Yeah. Yeah, so welcome, everybody. What I'm wanting to do with you today is kind of try to get a clear idea of what Vipassana meditation is about. And in order to do that, I'm going to go through, take a little journey in time. We start with modern day Vipassana practice. Then I'm going back in time, tracking that to a scheme of insight knowledges. And then I go back all the way to the early discourses. And for my presentation to work, I need your help. I need your cooperation. All alone, I can't do it, you see. In the first part, I'm going to introduce the three most wide-known meditation masters from Burma, Mahasi Sayadaw, Goenka, and Paok. And I'll just briefly tell you what I know about them, but I'm sure many of you have practical experiences. So it would be really lovely if after my short introduction you would be willing to expand on what I say, share your experience, your ideas, whatever practical experience you had. At this stage, it would not yet be the time for criticism of these traditions or of what I'm saying. That is, we can do that at the end. In this first part right now, I just want us to get a feeling for these three traditions. So, we have that mic somewhere, no? Yeah. So, it would be really lovely. Ah, there's two microphones. Wonderful. It would be really lovely if you are willing in front of this group to share your ideas. So, we start with Mahasi Sayadaw. That's the first of these insight meditation teachers who became widely known in the West. And the main technique that they use, the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition uses, mental labeling. The Mahasi tradition does not give emphasis to the former development of tranquility, samatha. And the labeling is applied when in sitting meditation, it's applied to the rise and fall of the abdomen as the main object of practice. And then anything else that happens is also labeled, thoughts, whatever other experiences. And the Mahasi tradition has a strong emphasis on walking meditation, usually they alternate between sitting and walking. And the walking meditation also, they use this labeling technique. And I believe they separate each step into four different phases, which they correlate with the four elements. And one of the powerful aspects of this technique is that they get a very clear grasp on intention, the intention that precedes anything that happens, any action that we do. Yeah, that's a little I know. So at this point, if any of you, I know there's one Mahasi practitioner in the corner. If any of you could like add something on top of what I said, that would be really lovely. Don't leave me sitting alone here. Yes, please.
So the practice that I have done with the San Jose Sangha, Mahasi Sangha's offshoot, we pretty much have to be mindful from the opening of our eyes in the morning to closing of our eyes at night, and doing daily practices, also washing, eating, every little action is broken down into subparts and noted. And any intention, as you said, wanting to eat, wanting to eat, etc.
Yeah, very powerful, this continuity of mindfulness that they emphasize. Thank you very much.
What I appreciate about the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition in my very limited experience, initially when I started to read Mahasi Sayadaw's short books was the precision and the clarity mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. which the clear intellectual power with mm-hmm. which he describes the practice and the mm-hmm. purpose of practice. So I thought that was very important
yeah.
for me.
Yeah.
I would use a slightly different word than labeling. I would say noting. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a very subtle difference there, but regardless. Labeling feels a little more active, whereas noting feels a little bit more mm-hmm. a part of awareness. And, mm-hmm. and the actual words can be left aside. Mm-hmm. Label really implies a word. Mm-hmm. Noting doesn't have to have a word.
Very good.
But
very
again,
good.
It's very subtle. And it's
no, but
just
it's a good point
experience.
To make.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, I think it's clear in the practice, again, from my own understanding, is that seeing the three properties of impermanence, suffering, mm-hmm. and not-self are a very important part of that practice.
Yeah.
And there's the idea that it can be achieved within a question of weeks or months, initial mm-hmm. understanding mm-hmm. of those three aspects of ourselves, mm. of our existence.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that was actually a very good point that from the gross labeling that the beginner might do, the practice moves more and more into a dropping of the concept than just bare noting. Thank you very much. Any other?
One of the things I can say, if you can repeat it, is that even though the rhetoric emphasizes vipassana, insight or mindfulness, the way that the retreats are set up with the continuity of practice and no work done whatsoever, that in Burma at least, that it's expected to have a very high degree of concentration to go with the mindfulness.
But it is the point I'm just trying to make in this comparison is that they do not dedicate time specifically to the development of samatha. They have this the idea of this kanika samadhi, the moment by moment concentration by being mindful.
But that concentration is very important, but it follows in the wake of the mindfulness.
Yeah.
But it's a very intense concentration, and so that's an important part of that tradition.
Yeah. Thank you. Right, we go to the next one. So the next tradition that spread to the West is S.N. Goenka, who and his teacher Uba King. And the Goenka tradition, the normal standard setup is they do these 10-day retreats where 3 days are given to the development of samatha, to mental concentration. And the next 6 days are given to insight meditation. I think the last day they do loving kindness. And the meditation technique is based on a kind of scanning of the body to feel sensations and to experience their impermanent nature. Again, any of you with any experience of the Goenka tradition, if you can add something on top of that. Goenka, yes, please. And then...
He taught a technique of body flow, sensations mm-hmm. in the body, and taught a method of paying attention, you know, of increasing that, you know, how to move from place to place
in the body.
And all that.
Thank you. There's a lady here, and then at the back.
Okay. Well, yes, as you said, the three first days you go into the
preparation
to calm the mind, and then you go through the body sensations. And the last goal is to just dissolve your body practically.
Yeah.
So to feel all these little, you know, tiny mm-hmm. kalapas, as you said, you know, and it's very intense and it's great.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Thank you. Directly behind you, the Indian lady.
I also did some
retreats with Goenkaji and Ji's group, and what I noticed was as they really put emphasis that you move quickly through your body,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly, mm-hmm. sometimes. And I realized that I was able to let go of my attachment to my body much more easily there mm-hmm. than in the Mahasi tradition. Mm-hmm. At least having experience of these two traditions, I feel that only when you do it, you realize that many more aspects mm-hmm. Come through than you would imagine by the sheer description of it.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Anyone else? Good, then I go to the next one. That is Paok Sayadaw. He's the most recent, and at present he is very successful. And Paok Sayadaw gives a lot of emphasis to the form and development of samatha, concentration. Ideally, all the different kamatanas described in the Visuddhimagga should be developed up to the level of four jhanas. And his vipassana technique is based on the four elements. The four elements standing for four basic qualities of matter: hardness, cohesion, temperature, and motion. And these are experienced in the body. And eventually the technique is meant to lead to experiencing the most finest parts of the body and even the subtle moments of the mind according to the Abhidhamma system, the mind moments. Again, anybody with practical experience can add anything on top of that. I think he's right now at IMS teaching a 3-month retreat. Yeah. A little bit far away to ask him.
I just came from there. That's a very good explanation.
Oh, thank you. Good, then we go ahead. So now, if I look at these three traditions, I find there are quite a number of differences. And one of these differences, if we look at them in terms of satipatthana meditation, where do we locate them? And I'm locating Mahasi Sayadaw under postures. Here I'm following Venerable Nyanaponika. The Mahasi tradition itself, and Jill, you correct me if I'm saying something wrong, actually say that they are observing the air element out of the four elements when they do the rise and fall. But according to my personal understanding, that doesn't really work so well, because the point of the contemplation of the four elements is to divide into four, not to pick out one of these elements. So I find that the best I can find as a match is following Venerable Nyanaponika, who says that the contemplation of postures and the clear awareness of that is the best place to locate Mahasi Sayadaw. And Goenka, obviously, feeling, contemplation of feeling, and Paok Sayadaw, or the elements. So if we speak in terms of satipatthana meditation, these three traditions are fairly clear, picking different objects. And if you look at the form and development of mental tranquility, as Jill rightly said, Mahasi Sayadaw has that moment-to-moment concentration, but they do not allocate special time for the development of mental tranquility apart from the vipassana practice. Goenka gives some space to it, and Paok Sayadaw gives quite a lot of space to it. And this is a rather much discussed issue in the Theravada tradition: how much emphasis needs to be given to mental tranquility, how much to vipassana. So within that spectrum, we again find that these three traditions take rather different positions. No, it always fascinated me that I have friends practicing in all three of these traditions, and when we meet as monks and we discuss our practice, it seems that it all comes together to pretty much similar experiences. And so basically the talk I'm giving today is based on that kind of like, what is the common thing among these three? And I find the common thing to be, and now I come to the second of my topic, the so-called scheme of insight knowledges, the Vipassana Jnana. These insight knowledges, as we now move back in time, terms of time, the We are in the around the 12th century work called Abhidhammata Sangaha, a handbook of Abhidharma. And this work is of rather central importance for Burmese. Burmese Buddhism gives a lot of emphasis to Abhidharma, but for them Abhidharma is not the canonical Abhidharma, but rather this particular manual. And it is interesting that the beginning of lay meditation as a mass movement, a very central figure in Burma for that is Lady Sayadaw. And I don't want to narrow the whole history of lay meditation down to Lady Sayadaw. There were also others like Mingun Sayadaw. But Lady Sayadaw had a rather key role in that whole situation. We are in Burma at the turn of the century. The British occupation, the fear Buddhism is getting lost. The idea when Buddhism is going to get lost, the first thing that will disappear is the Abhidharma. So what Lady Sayadaw did is he wanted to strengthen Buddhism in the country by encouraging laity to know and study the Abhidharma. And he did that through this Abhidhammata Sangaha. He created this Abhidhammata Sangaha study groups all over Burma. And out of that, in order for them to also put this Abhidhamma teachings into practice, he started to get them meditating. So I find that very interesting. There's a very nice PhD in Harvard University from 2008 by Eric Brown on Lady Sayadaw. And at that time, reading that PhD, I realized that connection, that this what stands at the background to some extent of this mass phenomena of lay meditation, which we all probably are quite aware of and affected by, is actually an attempt to understand Abhidharma. And that makes us also understand why many Vipassana teachers approach the practice through the glasses of Abhidharma. They look at the sutras from the perspective of the Abhidhammata Sangaha. They don't take the sutras on their own. For me, that was kind of a key understanding. So let us look what the Abhidhammata Sangha has to say on insight. There's a scheme of 10 insight knowledges according to the Abhidhammata Sangha. We have the same also in the Visuddhimagga, where the set of 10 is preceded by 2 knowledges, Paccaya Parigara and Nama Rupa Pariccheda. Basically, simply said, a basic understanding of causality, and in some way a distinction between the mental and the physical aspects of myself. These are the precondition for this series of experiences to take place. Now, lists are always problematic. You're probably all aware of that. It's not really that you work 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Yes, you got it. It's more kind of there's a certain basic dynamics that this listing is trying to tell us, which in actual practice will never exactly happen in that way. Nevertheless, lists are also useful to give us some general idea of what's happening. So if we just look at it from the perspective of meditation practice, number one, comprehension, a basic appreciation of the 3 characteristics in meditative practice: impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self. Out of that, the Udaya Bhayanjana, rise and fall. That's a key experience. Experiencing myself, body and mind, without any exception as something that is impermanent, something that arises and passes away. And this is the main working ground for Vipassana meditation. And it's not that easy, because we often have it that meditators do experience body passing away and part of the mind, but there's somehow often that feeling of that which knows impermanence being cozy little stable things. So everything else is passing away, but there's this very nice thing that I'm sitting back, and that experience of knowing that change. And it's very, very important to catch out that part. Because when that moves, things really are moving. Then really Vipassana starts. When everything is moving. Is it not working? Can you hear me all? Yeah, I don't want you to miss out on that. I'm saying that when I teach Vipassana meditation, one of the key points that I always try to get meditators to progress is that it is fairly possible to see body and most of the mind passing away. But that which is aware of change, it feels like a cozy little thing you lean back to. Ah, it's so nice, everything is passing away and you're flowing with the flow, it's all so nice. But when you catch out that one, it's like I'm losing the support and everything is passing away. Then it's really getting. And that is a really key thing. And once the experience of impermanence has become comprehensive in this way, there's another thing, you start a slight shift of perspective. You don't see rise and fall, you just see fall. It is a little bit like you're standing by a road or somewhere and you see cars coming, going, coming, going, coming, going. And at some point you just turn, just see going, going, going. It's just a shift of perspective. The practice is exactly the same. Object is the same. But there's a shift of perspective. Sometimes it happens naturally. Sometimes we encourage it. That everything passes. Chum, chum, chum. And you get the experience of dissolution. Everything is dissolving. Everything is falling apart. The whole world, as we experience it so far, is going to pieces. What happens next? Fear. Ooh, what's happening? And this is perfectly fine. Fear is part of the process. We're entitled to that fear because it's a fearful experience. And that is usually the dynamics you work through. Rise and fall, comprehensive rise and fall, disappearing fear. And the amount of fear that there is a very good measurement for the amount of holding on that we have. And when I deal with meditators in that stage, I usually tell them to have metta towards that fear, to accept that fear, because it's part of the process. And the fear is closely related to the understanding of disadvantage, adhina, what seemed so secure before. Now we see it's dangerous, actually. And out of that seeing of danger, there comes this beautiful nibbida, disenchantment, no longer being enchanted by these things in the outside world. Of course, we know it's all unstable. And the wish for something that is stable, liberation. And when you have gone through that dynamics, there comes a stage where the three characteristics are very, very clear. Reflection, and there's equanimity. It's very deep equanimity. And in that, if that previous momentum of letting go and seeing of the other inside knowledge is strong enough and carries through that level of equanimity, then the breakthrough can happen. Anuloma jnana, the mind is getting ready, and next come path and fruit, the experience of nirvana, stream entry. Maybe I stop shortly at this point and ask if there's any question, because from now on I'll move into other systems that describe the same type of experience. But perhaps at this point, if there's any question on these basic dynamics of insight that this scheme describes. Yes.
Would you just clarify number 5 again, disadvantage? What do you mean by the disadvantage?
Adhinava. That's usually part in the suttas, we have them as three. There's three things I can see in everything. There's the asara, that which gives me pleasure, which is nice about it. But there's also a problem with it. And that's the adhinava, the danger, literally translated. And then there's the nisarana, how you get out of this duality between it's nice, but there's a problem with it. And that is the basic sense behind that. Basically, there's the danger that before our whole way of experiencing and acting was based on the assumption of something stable. I am here, I'm experiencing these things out there, I'm enjoying them, I'm rejecting them. And the basis for this whole interaction since being born until now, and perhaps even in past lives, is dissolving. the house is built on sand, not on a firm foundation. And one suddenly realized the danger of that situation.
I have a better understanding now.
There's somebody there at the back, and then the lady over there. Yeah, when I give talks, those who have the mic, they get a lot of jogging to do.
Could you expand a little more on the dissolution of awareness? The dissolution of awareness, number three. Could you expand on that a little bit more?
There's some different interpretations of that. My understanding is that it is mainly the disappearing aspect of the thing that you have seen before as rise and fall. Excuse me. I think in the Goenka tradition, they have a slightly different understanding. They say that's when the compactness of the body dissolves and you experience the entire body in terms of changing kalapas. Which I think is also fine. The basic point is that you see that things are disappearing, that they are dissolving.
Think something about that which is aware of all of this disappears.
I find it difficult to hear you.
Did you mention something about what is aware of all of this?
That
dissolves as well.
That was what I was saying before, that we need to catch out that which is aware as a process in order for our understanding of impermanence to be comprehensive. That which is aware during meditation is not a stable entity. It is just a mental process. And if we see it as a stable entity, we're going the wrong way. It's very important. Because it's easy to see it as a stable entity. But if you've caught that point, even deep jhana will not be a problem. You will not latch on to the experience of the jhana as a something. Because you know it's a process. And only a process can experience. If this fella is totally stable, it can't have any experience because experience itself is change. It cannot understand anything. Even saying a word and you hearing the word must be change. Otherwise you couldn't hear the word, I couldn't say it. That is logic. Seeing it in experience is the second thing. Once you've seen it, you move ahead. But that's not specifically the question of dissolution. It's just the need to be very clear that impermanence means everything. Everything. There was a lady here, I think.
Is it sufficient to have experiences of rise and fall and dissolution only during meditation with eyes closed, or is that something one needs to experience even walking around, eating, doing daily practices for breakthrough through higher 8, 9, and 10 and further?
Well, the usual context where these insight knowledges develop the power to lead you to extremity would be during formal meditation. But some of them can be so powerful they carry on into everyday life. And they can sometimes, for people who are not prepared to that, they can be even so powerful that they don't know how to stop it. I had a friend, an Austrian, and he had never ever meditated, and he did a retreat, not in the Goenka tradition, but there's another branch, student of Ubakin, a lady, I forget the name right now. And so he comes from a Christian background, doesn't know anything about Buddhism, does this thing, and gets these very strong knowledges. And he said, "Anali, I never drank before in my life, but I went home and had a whole bottle of whiskey. I just wanted it to stop."
Could you say more about number 10? I didn't hear what you said.
Number 10 is just the moment when the mind gets ready for the breakthrough to stream entry. And that is a tricky transition there. That the same holds also for getting into a jhana. The mind that is on the brink of the breakthrough has to completely let go. It has to let... You with me? It has... It has to completely let go of the meditation to let it just be natural. It's a very difficult point. Same we have in jhana. You build up concentration. If you keep building, you never get there. There's a certain point where you have to let go, and just below you get in. And it's the same here. If you stay with equanimity and you have that dynamic, and you are making yourself or the experience something too prominent at that point, you're not getting it. But there's a moment of letting go, and then you go in. And that is what this anuloma, according to my understanding, is about. Conformity, to allow the mind to conform to the situation or something of that type, so that the breakthrough can happen. There's a lady here.
Could you say a little bit more about number 8, reflection? Could you say a little bit more about reflection? That person.
Reflection is very similar to number 1. Only that it has that maturity of the practice by having gone through the early experiences. Right, no more question, then we go ahead. Now you have just seen this nice system of 10, and I'm going to tease you with some other system. Ha ha ha. Here we are, Vimuttimagga. What's the Vimuttimagga? Vimuttimagga is a work preserved only in Chinese, and we know a lot what we don't know about it. Some scholars say it belongs to a monastery called Abhayagiri, which was there was a problem in Sri Lanka between the Mahavihara, which is the place where Buddha Gosa was staying, the Abhayagiri. So some scholars were speculating that this must be a work from the Abhayagiri Vihara, but closer inspection shows this is not conclusive. Some say it's from Sri Lanka, some say it's from India. Again, we don't know. What we do know, it is earlier than Visuddhimagga. And what we also know, Buddha Gosa was aware of it. And the interesting thing is, our Vimuttimagga gives the same scheme as you maybe already noticed in a shorter version. It's not, you see the same 10 are there, but it's only 6 steps. Some are brought together. And as we go further back, now we are back to the Pali Canon, Patisamvidamagga. Patisamvidamagga, we don't really know when it was composed. Scholars go from the 3rd century BC to the 2nd century AC. Patisamvidamagga is actually Abhidharma, which was too late to be included in the canonical Abhidharma collection. Therefore, it found its placing in the 5th Nikaya, in the Kodaka Nikaya. It's a great manual for meditators. It's a central reference point for meditators in the Theravada tradition. Lo and behold, only 5. Getting more condensed. So we see how these the key things are still there. There's the basic comprehension, the rise and fall, the dissolution. And then we get fear and disadvantage together. And the wish for deliverance and the equanimity come also together.
Can you go back one
more? Can go back one more and just have a look again. So basically what this tells us, again, as I said before, the list is not something to be latched on. It's just giving us one description, this is another description, this is another description. They're just different descriptions of basically the same process. So as I have the authority from Vimuttimagga and Patisamvidamagga to make it less, I'm going to make it even more less. This is Anali, you know, don't trust him. Yeah, I'm trying to bring it down to the 3 characteristics. That's actually what I'm really wanting to talk about today. The 3 characteristics. That's according to my understanding the essence of insight meditation. The 3 characteristics. And if I correlate them with the insight knowledges, first one, before I start getting into details, I'm not saying that anyone is only like this or only like this. I'm just saying there is a certain basic flavor we get. So from having seen all three characteristics, we first move predominantly into impermanence. And that is the basic working ground. And then from impermanence, we get more towards unsatisfactoriness, that whole, how shall we call it, that whole emotional process that is part of the development of insight. That letting go, that detachment, that fear, that disenchantment, that disillusion, all this is an emotional process that has to take place for vipassana to happen. And I put all this under unsatisfactoriness, that the realization that there is no satisfaction in these things. And then towards the end, we get more leaning towards not self, the equanimity, the conformity, and obviously with the experience of nirvana. That is the confirmation of not self. As I said, I'm not saying from 2 to 3 you're doing only impermanence, don't look at anything else, or there you're doing only dukkha, don't look at anything else. I'm only saying that there's a basic dynamic that goes through these insight knowledges. And this same basic dynamic, and now we come to the third of the three topics, is something we often find in the suttas, the three characteristics building on each other. This basic idea that we see that everything is impermanent. Because it is impermanent, it cannot give us lasting satisfaction. Because it cannot give us lasting satisfaction, it is not self, because the idea of self is something that should be lasting and giving satisfaction. We have different passages in the canon for that. One is, there's a series of sannyas. It's anicca sannya, perception of impermanence, followed by anicca dukkha sannya. Anicca is locative. In the impermanent perception of what is unsatisfactory. Dukkhe anatta sannya. In what is unsatisfactory, perception of not self. And the grammatical construction of this series makes it very clear that there's not a change of the object. It's the same thing that I'm looking at from three different perspectives. I see it as impermanent, I see the same thing as unsatisfactory, and I realize it's not self. And it's the same teaching that we find also in quite a number of discourses. Then we get the kind of a catechism on the five aggregates. So they work through the five aggregates, and it's always like rupam nityam va anityam va, body, is it permanent or impermanent? These are actually guided meditations in the suttas. And the monks say, anityam bande, venerable sir, impermanent. Yang pana nityam dukkam va rang sukkam va, what is impermanent? Is it dukkha or is it sukha? And the monks say, bante, dukkha. Yang pananichang dukkang viparinama dhammang kallang nutang samanupasitong etang mama esuham asmi esumiyatati. What is impermanent, unsatisfactory, of a nature to change? Is it really appropriate to look at that as, oh, this is mine, this I am, this myself? And the monk says, no, Bhante. So we see this progression through the three characteristics all through the suttas. And I think that is, according to my personal understanding, the essence of insight. Impermanence, the comprehensive experience of impermanence, the working on the disappearance aspect until we come to the understanding of dukkha. And from the understanding of dukkha, we come to letting go of all identification, I making with everything. And in order to give you a little visual idea of what I'm talking about. This is the bhanga, this is the disappearing. Everything is changing. Not only is it changing, it's kind of pulling me in or tearing things away from me. And from that we get that is dukkha. Dukkha is not suffering. No. It's just like the leaves on the tree become dry and they fall. We let go of things. And there they lie. And then comes not self. emptiness. Thank you very much for your attention. Time for question and answers.
I think it was number... Oh, sorry. This way. Can you hear me? Okay. Oh, there we go. On your first list...
It's up here.
Oh, yes. Number 9, I was wondering about the relationship between upekkha and the formations.
That's the expression they use, that you are equanimous towards whatever happens. And sankhara here has the very general meaning of anything that is compounded. Shall we go back to not self? No. That's a nicer one, yeah. I love that one. I wish I could take out all those planets and lights. That would be even better, but then you wouldn't know what I'm showing, you know? Yes, please.
If this question is all right, and I leave this to you, I would be very interested, and perhaps others would as well, in hearing what your own practice has come to be.
The three characteristics.
Okay, and how do you go about doing that in daily life?
In daily life, I don't do vipassana meditation. I practice metta in daily life. I have loving kindness. Actually, I don't like loving kindness. Benevolence is much better. Metta meditation is my main samatha practice. Uh-huh. And this is what I use for every day. Mm. I try to be towards whatever happens with an open mind and a friendly attitude. That is my day-to-day practice. Mm. And when I do vipassana meditation, I base myself on a practice of the Goenka type, but the technical aspect pretty much falls to the background, and I immediately go for the characteristics. My practice is very simple. I don't like it to be complicated. I just sit and I just see impermanence, and I see that for a long time. And then it moves to letting go. I like viraga, not so much dukkha. Viraga is a very nice term, viraga. We have that in Anapanasati Sutta, the part. There's anicca, and then comes viraga, and niruddha, patinisaga, viraga. It has this passing away thing, and it also has this dispassion kind of thing, and the two combine. Raga actually also means color, coloring. So it's like putting a beautiful, colorful thing out in the sun, at least in Sri Lanka, but you have a lot of sun here in California also. And after a month, you see how the color disappears. And you get disenchanted with it. It was so beautiful before, but now it's just a kind of dirty piece of cloth that you're not really excited about. All this is in viraga. So for me, viraga is the term that really gets me going, yeah. And then there's the total letting go. It's the not-self part. Not latching onto anything. No I, no me, no mine. And just letting go, letting go, letting go. And I don't even think about these. These are just basic feelings that pervade the experience. It's pretty much non-conceptual. I mean, if I have to talk about it, I have to couch it in these terms. Yeah, that's just my way. I love simplicity. Yeah. Lovely question. Microphone joggers move here in front.
Hi. I have a question about the three main... I have a question about the three modern day inside, the three teachers.
Yeah.
Are there techniques, do they chose the techniques from the sutras? And is just a liking of some aspect of the sutra that made them choose that technique? Because it seems like, you know, I go to Goenka. That's my main practice. But there is some message of this is the right way. And so now that I'm getting to know more the sutra, I have many questions about, you know, what makes some people choose some technique, which part of the sutra
comes. I understand. There's two things I would like to say to this. Well, maybe first, what I was trying to show is the historical framework in which these traditions grow up. And why they look at certain things. I mean, Kalapa is not found in the suttas. So why does he use Kalapas? Because they come from this Abhidhammata Sangha perspective. That was what I was trying to say with Lady Sayadaw. And why this emphasis on the four elements? Kalapas is closely related to the elements. Mahasi has the elements in the walking and even tries to interpret this. And Pauk is pure elements. Because Lady Sayadaw was talking a lot about the four elements. I'm just trying to show the historical antecedents that lead to a certain type of interpretation. And it is from that perspective then that these teachers approach the sutras. And they read, I mean, the other way how Goenka will read the Satipatthana Sutta is probably quite different from the way Mahasi will read it. The same text. It is perfectly fine. And now I'm coming to the second thing, and this is something, and maybe somebody of you can answer that to me. This is something I totally do not understand, why not only advanced meditators, but even meditation teachers think that what they do is the only right thing and everybody else is wrong. I simply don't. It seems to me like kindergarten, you know? Like, what I got is better than yours, you. Yeah, I fail to understand that. Why can you not do Goenka and I do Mahasi and we're both happy? That's just what suits me, and I'm so wonderful to hear how you do it and how interesting. I realize it can be done in another way, but I can still do it my way. Why? I don't understand that. If any of you has any comment on that, I would be very grateful because that bugs me for years now.
Precisely this aspect. I was just trying to understand what is the interpretation, because actually when you go to the Satipatthana study at Goenka, we are using your book. That's how
I was not talking about you, sister. No. I was not talking about you. You were just quoting a certain attitude. I was totally not talking about you. I have friends, monks, who do very intensive practice. And as soon as they come out, they want to tell me that what they have done is the only right thing and what I'm doing is completely wrong. You wanted to say something. Can you pass on the mic?
I'm not sure the value of this question, but I just something to... Oh.
It's pointed. It's right there. I have a soft voice, so I'll try. This question, I'm not sure of its value, so for what it's worth. You had said that the three characteristics were the essence of vipassana, or the essence of vipassana is the three characteristics.
Yeah, that is my perspective.
Right. And I just wonder how you would respond to this thought. The essence of vipassana is liberation, and the three characteristics create the raft.
Ah, you're wonderful. Lovely. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. You were very precise even before that with the labeling. I really appreciate that. Well done.
Well, I've read your book twice.
Oh, I've got to be careful now. after we come to him.
Okay. So I just have a comment regarding Pauk Sayadaw. While he emphasizes samatha in the beginning, if a meditator comes and wants to do vipassana, he will teach vipassana through the gateway of the four elements immediately.
Right, right.
So a meditator doesn't have to do jhanas. I just wanted to make that clarification.
And they believe that such a meditator can reach stream entry?
Well, I can't tell you what they believe, but my understanding is that he teaches samatha to stabilize the mind so that the vipassana will be more effective.
Yeah.
But if people really do not want to do that practice, he will teach four-element meditation.
Yeah, yeah.
And try to enter it through that doorway. So one is not compelled to do samatha if they don't want to.
Thank you.
Okay.
This gentleman here.
Thank you for your talk. I was wondering if you could go back to your slide.
Which one you want?
Let's see. That one, yes. I had heard some teachings where teachers say that the final entry point into nirvana is occasioned by an insight into one of the three characteristics.
Yes.
And so in a sense, I like how you start with comprehension as sort of a, maybe conceptual is not the right word, but a preliminary understanding of the three characteristics. And then maybe at the final point, you could enter into through any one of the three characteristics for
definitely,
the final point.
Definitely.
And then I've heard also that that corresponds, and I don't know whether it really matters at that point. You're just, it's not something you're thinking about, but it corresponds to your final attachment, be it if you're fundamentally and finally attached to wisdom, you'll enter through not-self. Fundamentally attached to samadhi or samatha, the calmness, you'll enter through dukkha. And through devotion, you'll enter through impermanence. And I just offer that as something that I've read and wondered if you had any comment on it. Thank you again.
This last correlation is not known to me. And I would have to reflect on that to be able to make any meaningful comment. But the other one, the point, the way I understand it is basically the Nibbana experience itself is a cessation experience. But how do you experience it? As animitta, or apanihita, or sunyata? These are the three doors to liberation. And that reflects on your character to some extent.
The connection I read about for the last one, devotion and impermanence.
Devotion would be saddha or faith?
Faith, yeah, faith and devotion is because there's a tendency sometimes with faith to expect a return. It's sort of the corrupting influence there that if you're attaching to a return, then you would enter through impermanence because you would see that there's going to be. I can't explain it exactly, but there's a sense that you're not going to get a return in a sense, and that's the final knowledge you have to carry into the experience.
Do you remember where you read this? Because I've never come across this before.
It was a lay teacher, and I've forgotten his name, but I read it in a book up at the library at Abayagiri. Be happy to look for it. And actually, I know exactly where it is in their library, so I can send it.
Let's go. Bye bye.
Well, I'll be there again. I'm happy to send it along.
Yeah. This is completely new to me, so I would have to reflect on that to see if that makes sense or not. I can't say anything offhand.
I really hate to speak about technique when so many senior practitioners are here, let alone Gil. But I will speak from my understanding in regard to the Mahasi Sayadaw practice. Mm-hmm. It's my understanding, and I've heard it spoken by a teacher who I respect in the tradition, actually last week at Spirit Rock, that there is not an intention to experience elements per se as, oh, I'm experiencing fire, or, oh, that's wind.
Mm-hmm.
And then my own interpretation of that is when I follow the rise and fall, distension is something that I can experience. It's a sensation.
Mm-hmm.
And it is in the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
But this is my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it seems like there needs to be a conceptual leap to then go, oh, that's wind.
Mm-hmm.
And when I make that leap, if I were to make that leap, and if I were to intentionally do it consistently in my practice, I think I would really be in concept and not in the true experience in the present moment of what's occurring in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I think an analogy to that, or perhaps another instance of that, we often talk about the pain in our knees. Mm-hmm. And actually it was mentioned, the idea that initially we experience the body perhaps anatomically, like, oh, my belly is rising, mm-hmm. or, oh, that's my knee that's hurting. But then as we look more carefully at the sensations, we see perhaps burning or stinging or heat or however you may experience that which is going on in your knee. So it's not my understanding that there is this intention to sort of categorize our experience or see our experience as elements. I could be wrong, but that's my understanding.
I'm not sure in what direction we are going now.
My understanding from one of the slides was that there was this categorization of the three different teachers.
Yeah,
Mahasisayadaw sort of mentioned elements.
Postures. I had put him under postures following Vrimalanana Ponika. Oh,
okay.
Because this categorization was based on the basic exercise used. And the Mahasi tradition says that rise and fall of the abdomen is an observation of the wind element. And I'm saying that the problem was that when Mahasi started to move from the traditional place for mindfulness of breathing here, then some traditional monks stood up and criticized him quite strongly for that, because this is already, this is in suttas, it's just called Parimukha, and that term is relatively open, but already with the Vibhanga, second book in the Abhidhamma canon, it said Nasika Mugacha, Nasika Mukha Nimittacha. Okay, the nose, the nostril, and the upper part of the mouth. So there's a very precise location, and Theravada tradition and things, that is the place where you should do mindfulness of breathing. So when they start to do it here, there's a conflict with the traditional understanding. And in order to avoid that conflict, correct me if I'm wrong, the interpretation was proposed, okay, we are not doing mindfulness of breathing, we are observing the wind element out of the four elements. This is how I was explained that this interpretation came about. But then, to my understanding, it doesn't work, because the contemplation of the four elements, we get the simile of a butcher. Cow has been slaughtered and cut up into pieces. The butcher doesn't no longer look at it as cow, but as this and that type of beef. The idea of the four elements is to separate ourselves into different parts, not to take out one of these elements and observe it. Which is why I then said, let's follow Vrimalanana Ponika. Where do I have it? And put Mahasisayadaw under postures. I'm not saying he's only doing postures. I'm not saying that's the only way. I was just trying to put him somewhere to show the different approaches.
Yeah, it didn't make any... I mean, I understand what you're saying. It mm-hmm. seems like, you know, the nostril supposedly became too subtle, really, to be a persistent object, is something that I've heard. But I just don't understand, and it's not so important that I do understand how Mahasisayadaw winds up as postures, but that's fine.
That's Jnanaponika saying, because they do a lot of walking meditation, and this is what somebody here said it before, that continuity of mindfulness, being aware of everything you do, and that fits very much with the basic idea of contemplation of postures, which gives that idea of continuity in whatever you do, that strong... You said that about the continuity of mindfulness, even working for the kind of concentration part.
Okay.
And there's some lady over here. I don't know. Yeah, you did it. Yeah, thank you. This monk has no memory. I'm sorry. So that is why Jnanaponika put it there. And I find that if I have to put Mahasi somewhere, I find that very convincing argument. The other thing you said about the using categories, and I just we recently in August we had this mindfulness conference in Hamburg, and the whole topic was this Kabat-Zinn and this mindfulness based stress reduction and the idea of mindfulness they have, and we had scientists from different areas and also scholars, and we also tried to get Gil there, but he didn't want to come. He wanted to stay with all of you. And we had a very nice discussion, and what came very clearly out is that the understanding of mindfulness as non-conceptual is not supported by the canon. Mindfulness does not mean, oh, no concepts, just be aware. Satipatthana Sutta very clearly says, recognize pleasant feeling. Sukham vedanang vidyamana. Sukham vedanang, they give quotation marks in Pali. Sukham vedanang, I feel happy feeling, I feel unpleasant feeling. So the wise use of concepts is part of mindfulness practice. That should be very clear. Doesn't mean blah, 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 tomorrow I'm going to meet my friend and then I'm going to go here and there. Not that automatism, the mind running on its own. But the deliberate use of concepts and even of evaluation, this is a worldly feeling. This is an unworldly feeling. This body is not beautiful. I am having anger in my mind. I am having lust in my mind. This is part of mindfulness practice according to early Buddhism.
I don't disagree at all with what you're saying.
I was just using the occasion to get this out.
Oh, okay, yeah. I don't think that means that, you know, fire is what we're supposed to note when we have pain in our knee, but anyway.
Yeah, I was just using you as to get this out. I think it's important to get it out. Yeah. Can you pass on the mic?
I'm hoping you could give a bit more historical perspective, either with these three teachers or before them, in the changing views of the balance between knowing an intellectual scheme versus the pure experience. This has come to light for me because I've studied with Gil for 5 or 6 years, reading the suttas, digging into this part intellectually, and then watching my father near the end of his life, who has intuited the three characteristics.
Who?
My father, who is on his way to dying soon. And just in his own experience, with no Buddhist study, hasn't even listened much to what I've been doing the past few years, mm-hmm. he's intuited the three characteristics. I doubt he'll reach liberation, but he's come a long way. And so I'm curious, what has been the sweep of history in Buddhism of how one should teach? Is it what had been the relative balance of teaching meditation as experience and practice versus study of suttas or other schemes?
It seems that we have very, very little information about meditation going from the 19th century back. Pretty much we don't really know what happened. We have the impression that some monks by themselves may have been practicing. But it seems that while it is very clear that early Buddhism, the time of the Buddha, and I would say the first 2 centuries afterwards, the emphasis was on meditation, and lay people were meditating, there was a stronger move towards scriptural knowledge. And that seems to have taken over. But we don't really know, because we simply don't have sources. We don't have much knowledge about that. And I myself, when I had just become a monk in Thailand, in 1990, and I thought, oh, type of Bodhidharma kind of thing, no scriptures, leave me alone, I'm just going to practice. And so I lived there, very beautiful. There was a mountain, on top of the mountain there was a cave, and on 3 sides there was the seaside, and I just had to go down to the village Pindapara to get my food, go out, and meditating, but nothing really happened. I was not as clever as your father, you see. And then somebody gave me Jnanaponika's Heart of Buddhist Meditation. That made the whole difference for me. And this is why I'm now even become a scholar. I mean, this may be going a little bit too far. But I think there must have been a reason why the Buddha gave so many discourses. Why didn't you just say, hey, psht, sit, that's it. And now the image I have is like when you want to make bread. So you have the dough, no? And you're kneading the dough. But you also need yeast. And the kneading of the dough is the practice of meditation. But the yeast is the knowledge of the suttas that makes it go all into a real bread of understanding. That is the simile I like to use for that. Microphone juggers, move.
Thank you very much. I have a question, and I hesitate a little bit to ask because I'm going to have to say something about my personal experience And so I'll stop right here and ask you if it is okay for me to ask this question, or should I ask you one-on-one?
It is up to you.
Okay. All right. I don't mind. Certain experience of impermanence, I did have fear arising, especially following Bhanga, I had fear arising. But there were certain experiences of impermanence where I realized that the mind and body are processes. It was just joy.
Yeah.
So is that because I have read so much or conceptually? I didn't feel that way. It felt like it was a lifting of a burden.
Yeah.
And then following that, another experience of impermanence was, wasn't so much impermanence as in the processes just go on. There is no stop button.
Yeah.
And that was real experience of suffering. So I felt like, oh my, I wanted to find that shut off switch. You know, it was just like there was no escape.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I realized there was no escape even when I slept because there were dreams.
Yeah, very good.
So I have never heard of anybody talk about the joy part of it. And so I was wondering if that was more conceptual or it was wrong or just common.
It was perfectly right, sister. Joy is a fact of awakening. Joy is so important. Yato yato samasati kandhanang udayabhayang labati piti pamojang ammatang tang vijanatang. As one sees with mindfulness the rise and fall of the aggregates, one gets piti pamoja, happiness and bliss, and one will come to see the deathless. That is a Dhammapada verse. Joy is the most important thing in meditation. Absolutely crucial. Unworldly joy, not the worldly type. Absolutely crucial. So if you have joy when seeing impermanence, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
I'm curious about your recent comment about mindfulness involving knowing what's happening. My experience is there's a difference between this kind of knowing and what's translated as conceiving usually, like in the first sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya where, you know, these things. And conceiving is more related to clinging.
That's manyati.
Uh-huh.
That's a different term.
Okay.
Patavi manyati, pataviya manyati, patavi meti manyati. One conceptualizes earth, I am earth, this is my earth.
Right.
Mula pariyaya, beautiful.
So it has, but I just wanted to clarify in mindfulness. I mean, you talked about your own practice as being non-conceptual and...
pretty much non-conceptual. I'm just saying that there is no need to be afraid of concepts.
Right.
You're perfectly right. This mula pariyaya kind of rummaging in the mind about things and, this is... my glass and blah, blah, blah. This is not what we want.
Right.
But at the right moment, to sharpen clarity of understanding, just this.
Yes.
That's perfectly fine.
Okay.
And it's deliberate. I've chosen to call this impermanent or dukkha. It's not something that I'm just being pulled away by it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a deliberate choice. I'm saying within my meditation, it is perfectly fine to say pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, neutral feeling, etc.
Right.
But not, tomorrow morning, well, I don't know, I have a flight, I don't know what is Gil giving me for breakfast, I would like to have something nice, I hope he remembers, blah, 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 blah. No, that's
right.
You got the point, huh?
Okay, so you think that sutta is referring to that?
Yeah, manyati, very clearly. The term is manyati, manyana, that has a very negative connotation.
Mm-hmm. It has the I involved in it.
Exactly. It's a beautiful way how it shows the construction of I by relating to the object in different cases in the Pali. Very beautiful, very powerful sutta.
Right. Thank you.
Anybody interested, Bhikkhu Bodhi has given some talks on that. Very good. looks like we're coming to the end. Yeah. So, thanks to all of you for the attention. I enjoyed talking a little bit about Vipassana with you, and I wish all of you well. May you be happy and healthy, and may all of you progress on the path to liberation. Thank you. Time for tea.